Hello everyone, this is Stefan Sasse. Today in the fifth issue of the big podcast hour on Boiled Leather, and I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, having written some essays to more or less varying topics. With me today are two guys instead of the usual one. We know the usual one who will present himself now.
Hello, I am Sean T. Collins. I am the blogger behind BoiledLeather.com, aka All Leather Must Be Boiled, and I co-wrote the annotated Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia and Ann Grohl for Subtext.com. And yes, joining us today is a very, very special guest from a podcast of Ice and Fire. Amin, tell us who you are.
Hi, everyone. My name is Amin. I'm one of the hosts of the podcast of Ice and Fire, the longest-running podcast that's still active in the Song of Ice and Fire series. I'm from Canada, and I've been reading the books since just before A Storm of Swords came out, and I'm really excited to be here.
We're quite a United Nations of Ice and Fire fandom today.
I think
we have three different countries represented, so good for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we're setting a good example for the world.
Yeah, peace and harmony and everything. Okay, then we will have two topics for you today, two big topics, and perhaps we will delve into some minor ones at the end, or if we cannot discipline ourselves. So the first topic will be titled Southron Ambitions, which only by chance and happenstance, of course, is also the title of one of my essays, in which I discussed a great conspiracy that may or may not have happened prior to Robert's Rebellion. So, Amin, what do you think about the theories that I laid out there?
I thought, like your usual work, like I've been following your essays on Tower of the Hand. It was a great article. It kind of put together a lot of issues I had floating in the background. I've had some of these ideas before, and I'm sure a lot of other people have had these ideas, but you put them together in one essay and tied it all together. So I thank you for that. And I think that the main point of your essay is that we, reading the books, especially the first time, we kind of take it for granted that this series of events happened, but there seems to be actually some sort of structure going on before the war, and otherwise things would not have gone the way they did. It wouldn't just gone like that way randomly. There was some negotiation, there's some diplomacy going along there, and I'm looking forward to just chatting about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to catch people up with essentially what we're talking about, if you haven't read Stefan's essay, and in that case, I advise you to pause this podcast and go click the link that will no doubt be attached to it and read it, we're discussing Lady Dustin's conspiracy theory that she advances about Eddard's father and John Arryn and sort of the previous generation of lords around the Seven Kingdoms intermarrying their children, which was a little bit odd, and perhaps indeed having ambitions about the Iron Throne that justified Mad King Aerys' paranoia somewhat. Up until we get this sort of speech from the lady in A Dance with Dragons, we've assumed that Aerys' paranoia was pretty much just that, paranoia, although it could have been, and probably was, fed by Varys to a certain extent. But now we see that there might be more to it than that, and Stefan's essay delves into why it may not just be shit-talking from a jaded lover, why it actually there may be some truth to it, based on what we can see from the books.
I think we have two more or less parallel theories about this this thing going on, because Lady Dustin blames mainly the Maesters for it, which she calls the Grey Rats, and she always says that they are influencing everyone, and she advises Theon, of all people, not to listen to the Maesters because they are evil and they have this big conspiracy going. And I developed my theory more or less on the general idea that there was some kind of coordinated policies at last between the great houses, but not necessarily involving the Maesters. That may be possible, but since I'm generally not a fan of the big conspiracy theories, I try to make up a variant in which they are not present. And if you think this through, it makes for a very uncanny effect, because then the bad King Aerys, who just kills everyone in paranoia, wouldn't have been that wrong all along. And this is kind of interesting, I think. And I have read the books many, many times over, as you surely all have, and it didn't occur to me until not a month ago or two. So it is buried deep in there, or I am just hallucinating, I'm not sure. But at least I think it's worth discussion.
Yeah, and one thing that I would say before we really kind of delve into it ourselves is that I think it's perfectly feasible that it is true. It seems like kind of a big idea to be introducing this late in the game, but it's obviously not alone in being a very big idea that Martin is introducing this late in the game. In the same pair of books, A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, which Stefan has argued very persuasively should be viewed as one giant book, since that was how they were intended originally, you also have the first inklings that the Maesters, in addition to whatever role they may have played in the political machinations of the Arryns and the Starks and the Baratheons and the Tullys and so on, and the Lannisters, supposedly have this anti-magic agenda, an anti-dragon agenda, that they have pursued through various means, perhaps. They may have sent a hit squad to attack Dany. Meanwhile, we also all of a sudden have a hidden Targaryen on our hands in the person of young Griff. Whether he's real or not, we don't know. I tend to doubt it. But that's a big, big new antagonist to introduce, you know, this deep into the series. So just on that level, on the level of narrative plausibility, I think it's entirely possible that this bears out. I don't think this is just all of a sudden someone concocting a whole bunch of theories about, you know, I don't know, nanotechnology playing a role. I think it's completely feasible that this could have occurred this way.
I just have a quick question for you, Stefan. So basically, you're saying that John Arryn is the linchpin behind this rather than the Maesters? Is that the view that you're going with?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. It seems like the most logical choice because with him in his person, all the strings at least cross. I don't say they come together, but here the major elements are all in place. You have Robert Baratheon for the Stormlands, Eddard Stark for the North. You have obviously the Vale of Arryn itself, and at least some connection to Riverlands and Westerlands as well. So I think that Jon Arryn plays a major part in it. If only because the other two guys are dead or will soon be at that point. I mean, Stephen Baratheon, he drowned, and so can't be present to do anything. And Rickard Stark will soon be dead by the hands of Aerys, so it will naturally fall to him. But he is definitely a major link piece in it. Mm. I hope that did answer your question.
Yep, it did.
Okay, the general idea why I came up with it in the first place is that most marriages we hear from and we witness in the books are between houses within the kingdoms themselves. Normally, an overlord marries into the house of a vassal that he needs to tie to himself. That's the main reason for most of the marriages that there are. We know, for example, that I believe it was the father and mother of Rickard Stark were married to the clansmen to bind them to Winterfell. Or Minissa Tully, the mother of Catelyn and Lysa and Edmure, she was a Wend before. So obviously Hoster Tully had the desire to bind Harrenhal to his cause. And suddenly all the big houses start to make marriages among themselves. And not only one or two of them, but virtually everyone except for Dorne and the Reach. They are all starting to marry their offspring. And it seems rather odd in the precise moment and the atmosphere of that particular time. And it could be that they at least tried to coordinate to present a joint face against the Iron Throne.
Yeah, that's basically the point where you say they only marry outside their area to seal a peace or to seal an alliance. That really struck out to me when I saw that. Seal a peace like the Dorne and the Targaryens, the Brackens and the Blackwoods. But they're already at peace, so it's got to be an alliance of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. And the big question following here is, what are they up to? And of course, here it is pure speculation. What I said is what seemed most logical to me in that point, but of course you could argue that there are a lot of other explanations and theories that are equally viable for that. So if you have any comments or criticism on that, I'm definitely open for debate, because much as I wish, I'm not exactly that perfect.
Well, I'm curious. So you were thinking that they kind of, although they were not working with Rhaegar, they may have had the same goal of putting Aerys aside and putting Rhaegar in power, somebody more trustworthy in power?
I'm not sure whether they had such a clear-cut objective. My general theory is that it is more of making options, making room, and creating a leverage that they can use later. They definitely don't work together with Rhaegar Targaryen, because then the events must have developed in some other way. They, by chance, follow more or less the same objective as Rhaegar, if the few bits of information we have about his objectives are true as we read them. But that's more or less by chance and happenstance. I think what they want to do is to strengthen their power in comparison to the Iron Throne. They are more or less for states' rights, if you want to transport it to a more familiar political setting. They don't want, in quotation, the federal government to be as strong as it is, especially if you have a mad king in position and don't know what will come after. They try to strengthen the single kingdoms and let them work together to avoid exactly the bloodshed that this will create ultimately.
So, Sean, what do you think? Like, do you think that it was the houses or the maesters behind this alliance thing?
You know, my problem with these maester theories is that we really don't know enough about it, because we certainly haven't seen any evidence from any of the individual maesters we've met. Including Maester Cressen, who is a viewpoint character and presumably could have been thinking about these things at some point. Obviously, he had other things on his mind at the time. But we got no inkling from him that his feelings about Melisandre and her sorceress ways were tied in any way to some sort of overarching ideology imposed on him by the Citadel. And that would have been like a natural thing for him to be thinking about. Anyway, that's basically my problem with the Maester theories, is that They could pan out, you know, that makes sense in both cases. I could sort of see it making sense, although I don't really see what their angle is. Of course, their angle would be getting rid of the Targaryens. If they're anti-dragon and anti, you know, blood of the dragon, that's their angle. That's why they would participate in some grand scheme to unite all the great houses against the Targaryens. So, maybe, just in the process of telling you why I'm not sure about the Maesters, maybe I became a little more sure about the Maesters. I don't know. Two other things struck me just here, listening to you guys talk just now. One is the possible involvement of Rhaegar, who seemed to have some reformist ideas and express the intention after, if he were to win the war, he would come back to King's Landing and things would be different or whatever. One of the reasons that I don't think we can firmly rule out Rhaegar's involvement in this plot, despite what ends up happening with the war and him going to war with these people and battling with some of the family members involved personally, is that the prophecy is a wild card here. He may have had one set of intentions and made an agreement before he had whatever vision or prophecy sort of set him in motion with regards to Lyanna. That's a real game changer for him. And I get the impression, I don't really recall when in the time frame that happened, and I could be completely wrong, but it does seem like it's at least possible that he was planning to do one thing, and then that happened, and then his plans changed. The other thing that struck me is this, and I know this is only sort of quasi-canonical, I think. This was introduced in a role-playing game or something, but the War of the Ninepenny Kings, which, as Stefan points out, is where Jon Arryn, Stefan Baratheon, Rickard Stark, Hoster Tully, and Tywin Lannister perhaps sort of all got together. I think the idea there was that a bunch of warlords and tough guys from Essos, 9 of them, got together and decided to sort of pool their resources to conquer various places all at once, you know, supporting one another and doing this. Maybe in fighting the Malus the Monstrous, who was the Ninepenny King of Westeros, or would be King of Westeros, they were like, well, we don't really like this guy or his friends, but, you know, his idea wasn't so terrible. That was something that just literally just occurred to me, that, you know, if that turns out to be the story of the War of the Ninepenny Kings, which really hasn't been described in the books themselves, that, you know, right there, that may be where the seed was planted.
Which is kind of ironic, because in defending the Targaryens there, the seeds were planted for their ultimate downfall.
Right, yeah, yeah, very much so.
Yeah, that is really a thought that's quite unsettling, especially from a Targaryen perspective. But right. The War of the Ninepenny Kings is important in any case for these guys to meet, because, I don't know, you just threw me off the rails a little bit with this quasi-canonical thing, because I'm not quite sure where the informations are in the books and if they are in the books at all. But at least we have connections like the Littlefinger's father serving with Hosted Tully. They know each other from the War of the Ninepenny Kings, and I think that the Baratheons and Starks and Arryns know each other from the war, because they were all young men when they were fighting it. Mm-hmm. And no matter what conclusions they drew of it, and conspiracies hatched maybe already when they fought on the Stepstones, at least they got to know each other. And we know that these connections in the early years of a lord are very important, and they can last a long time. And yeah, well, there we are.
One of the things that really struck out to me while I was reading your article, it's kind of a side point, but was what Mace Tyrell was doing at Storm's End. Because up to this point, I thought that most people, he was just an incompetent guy that couldn't take the city. But the way you look at it is that he was trying to avoid taking a risk with his army, and what better way than to just plant it at the city and just sit there?
Yeah, definitely. It could be that Mace Tyrell, or whoever controls him, because I think he really is not the brightest guy in the room, but he has some competent advisors, at least. His mother, for example, surely is a sharp tool, and she might have just got him on the way, like in, you have to conquer Storm's End, or else nobody will accept you, so don't leave Storm's End until you have it, and don't build catapults. They are superfluous. Something like that, you know. And then they would be virtually ensured that the Tyrell force commanded by Mace Tyrell would not really engage into the war at all. But I don't know whether this is true or not.
Well, she didn't like Targaryens, actually, I think. I think she said they were going to marry her to one.
Yeah, really. Now that you say it.
Yeah.
The dangerous thing about these conspiracy theories, once you start with them, you always find new stuff to put in them. And then, didn't he tell, and it could be possible, and that secret organization also wants. And soon you have these all continent-wide conspiracy theories, and you can't really know what was true and was not. But it's always fun to talk about it.
Yeah.
As you were saying, Sean, that the one thing that I could think of the Maesters going for is maybe being anti-Targaryen because of the magic, because the other theories I've been hearing is kind of conflicting. I mean, in one sense, they might want Seven Kingdoms because they can control it more likely, but the other sense, if they're for knowledge, a United Kingdom might be better for spreading knowledge. So it's kind of hard to see what their ultimate goal is.
Yeah, if they have one at all. I mean, the big problem that I have with the Maester conspiracy theory is the same that I basically have with every conspiracy theory that involves a great organization. You just have to keep this thing a secret for centuries, and then you have to organize and orchestrate it in a very difficult and complex way and still keep it a secret. And if it ever becomes apparent what you're doing, everything will go down the toilet. I mean, if the Maesters really had such a long-term goal as to get rid of the Targaryens or stuff like that, and only one squeezy acolyte ever talked about it, all of them would be fucked, and fucked for good. And that's just a risk you don't want to take. I mean, they would lose everything. Now they are in the castles in all the kingdoms, and if such a conspiracy was to be detected, they would be nothing at all. They would all be killed, simple as that. And I don't know why they should take that risk. What do they gain? More power than they already have, for what? I don't exactly see the motivation and the the relation between what you can gain and what you can lose. It just doesn't seem like something that clever people do.
That's a good point, Stefan. I mean, you and I always bring in real-world politics into our discussions, and you know, I think this is the undoing of real-world conspiracy theories. How can you get dozens or hundreds or thousands of people over the course of years or decades or centuries to all agree to do something, to all work to do it, but to do it in secret and never reveal it? It's just a little tough to swallow. And while I believe that it's possible that the Maesters could have, you know, certain elements of their training or, you know, I don't even know what you would call it, you know, what makes them Maesters, that sort of binds them to some ideology that the larger public isn't privy to, it does become a little bit difficult to believe that they've been advancing this master plan in secret for so long. However, strategically placed Maesters, you know, a handful of them, very trusted ones, placed in the right position, could do a lot of damage on this score. And I suspect that if the Maesters are involved in some grand anti-magic, anti-Targaryen conspiracy, that's how it worked. Not that everyone, not that Maester Cressen and Maester Luwin and all these people scattered hither, thither, and yon are all in on it, but Grand Maesters are in on it, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Or you know, this Maester that they're sending to supposedly advise Daenerys Targaryen, he would be in on it. You don't necessarily need to involve everybody. The other thing about the Maesters that I've seen people on, I think probably the Westeros message board, point out, is that the Maesters are based in the Citadel, which is ruled by the Hightowers, who are vassals of the Tyrells, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So if you want to loop Mace Tyrell back into the equation and try and put your finger on what his involvement in all of it was, that's one angle. I have never, and this is a case where we just don't know enough about the Hightowers to know how deeply involved they are in what the Maesters do, or how deeply involved they are in what the Tyrells do. So they're the missing link in that case. But that is a potential link.
Hmm. Absolutely. I think the only real information we are getting about the Maesters is in A Feast for Crows, in the prologue chapter with Pate, and then when Sam finally arrives there. And from the impressions that I get from these chapters, the Maesters don't really act in unison. The Citadel seems more like a snake pit, where every Grand Maester aspires and conspires against the other ones in search for parts of the budget and power and certain books or artifacts or whatever they aspire to. But they don't seem like an organization that is closed off from the world and pursues a united goal. They are more like very sophisticated and a very closed off and isolated cosmos in which they work. And I don't see these guys really aspiring as a unity for more power or some greater objective in Westeros. Single Maesters, yes, of course. Guys like, what was his name? The magic one now off to Daenerys.
Marwyn the Mage.
Marwyn the Mage, yeah. Thanks. That guy, he could certainly aspire to more. But he, for example, is shunned by most of the other Maesters. And why would they do that if they had some great conspiracy to protect or to move forward? Then they would either try to include him or to get rid of him. But they certainly would not just ignore him and let him sit there and make his own plans. So I don't think that this is a really sound theory to build on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think in a lot of ways, like I said, it's just one of those things where the jury is still out because we don't have enough information really about what they're like. I keep coming back to the fact that we've met a lot of Maesters, we've had one as a viewpoint character, and we've heard very little of this from anyone except Marwyn the Mage, I suppose, and Lady Dustin, who are the definition of unreliable narrators, if you ask me.
Yeah.
So it's just tough. It's just difficult to say.
Well, if you're looking at it from a multi-generational conspiracy, then it does become hard to believe. But if you look at what if you say if it's just that Rickard's generation and where Wallace's father is behind this idea, then you only need a few people knowing the conspiracy, and the rest just obey. Like, meaning they're trained to serve and to obey the Citadel.
That's true.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a problem for me. The thing is, that would be some people, they would conspire and they would make plans and they could keep them secret and make contacts and stuff. That's the usual things. But that wouldn't include the Citadel and the Maesters as a whole. And that's where my problems really started. The Maesters did that, as opposed to to the one Maester of Rickard and perhaps his father. It's okay. That is a scale I can accept, that I can believe. But I certainly won't believe uniform collective organizations plotting for centuries and generations.
Yeah, I mean, if you're someone like Lady Dustin or Marwyn the Mage and you feel politically opposed to the Maesters and to the Citadel, then it's quite easy to take the Maesters' rationalism, which that we have seen. You know, we've seen that from Lewin on down. You know, they tend to dismiss the idea of magic as a going concern in the world anymore. You know, they have a more rational, more, you know, sort of proto-scientific viewpoint of the world. It's easy to lump that in with whatever you think their active, conspiring might be, and put the two together and say, oh, and it's all part of one big grand conspiracy, whereas one is just, you know, a relatively harmless way of looking at the world that maybe you disagree with. And then the other, perhaps, actually is them intervening in a clandestine fashion in the politics of the realm. You know, then maybe that's where you get these grand conspiracies from, is people who have a sliver of the right idea, then lumping it in with Maesters as a whole, because, you know, Maesters as a whole do display a certain bias against magic and magical creatures, and you could make that connection where none perhaps really exists, except in a very, very small and elite number. My take on it, anyway.
Yeah. Definitely. We also shouldn't forget that the Maesters will provide the setting, the ground rule for a clash of mentalities with certain lords, especially in the North, because most of them are Southerans. They believe in the Seven Gods, to various degrees. Most of them will not be really pious believers, but they are raised in this belief. They have this very strong belief in science and this scientific academic approach to things. And if you live in the North or in another more or less remote area, that isn't exactly something that you can relate to. Maesters will then seem very alien to you and not really from this world, you know what I mean? And that is a good ground for conspiracy theories. It's basically the one thing that leads up to this. And Lady Dustin is a prime example for this. What should a woman in her position ever have to relate to a maester that comes from Old Town? Their worlds are totally different. So their everyday experience, from the weather to the forces of nature that ravage the North, and the Maester can do nothing about this. He can tell you, oh yes, that's because the cloud does X and the wind does Y. But what does that help you when your grain is destroyed before winter, you know? It is just another people, another kind of culture. And that always creates tensions.
That's a great point, that they're just different and we fear what's different. I mean, she doesn't call it Maester ambitions, she calls it Southron ambitions, and that to me shows right away that she's biased against that region and all the people in it, and, you know, their religious background and whatever other background they have. And I feel I sort of vaguely remember something like that coming up in some of the Iron Islands chapters. I can't remember who, you know, but they don't like reading, they don't like Maesters. You know,
Tarion, I think, has a maester on his ship that he despises, and I mean the maester is even raped by his men, and he says just like, well, you should fight him off.
Yeah, there you go. You know, so these regions that do have a different religious and cultural background, they don't like the maesters. And you're right. I mean, again, you need look no further than the real world. You know, when we see something different, like it's obviously part of some vast grand conspiracy among all those kinds of people, you know, those kinds of people, you know, to do something bad. And that's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to invoke Godwin's law a little bit, but you don't have to look farther than the Nazis and their great Jew conspiracy, that the Jews are behind it all, because they were foreigners to them. They were alien, they had other customs, you didn't quite understand them, but they were near enough as to demonize them, and it is the same stuff in every country. It is repeatedly, and you always have the same formula for this stuff. People that seem close, that seem related, but on some very fundamental issue aren't, be it religion or a line of thought or simply the region of origin. They don't trust the Dornish, for example. Okay, we know they have reason to, but nobody trusts the Dornish. They are also all the time called the Dornish. No one ever speaks from the Riverlanders or the Westerlanders. Then it's Tywin Lannister or it's the Tullys. But with Dorne, it's the Dornish. They're all the same, basically. And they have the same thing. So it's
weird. Yeah, I mean, I live in New York City, and in recent months, the NYPD has gotten in some trouble, not enough, if you ask me, but for basically using 9/11 as an excuse to bug and, you know, spy on basically every Muslim in New York City. And there's this training video that they were showing, you know, that the terrorists are already among us, they're infiltrating mosques all across the country, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and
it's
about
the exact same thing, you know, it's the exact same thing. They took the actions of, like, a small group of assholes and extrapolated it to an entire group of perfectly innocent people who just, you know, just want to go to the grocery store or whatever, and they have, like, you know, cops following them. I mean, it's really quite sad and predictable, and it's the same kind of thing here, perhaps.
Yeah, with the added feature, so to speak, that if you are the victim in such a conspiracy theory, you don't have to have done anything at all. No member of your community has to, because we don't have any proof of a maester doing such a thing, or a Dornish really aspiring for a big war if he is not by any chance a daughter of Oberyn Martell. So, they just get this pile of shit over their head, and I mean, the cops in New York, they even did something, but these guys, there is really no reason other than cultural prejudice. So, okay, Eamon, do you have any other notes left for
I have a couple of questions actually from your article, but just a final point on the Maesters, because we've been kind of talking with them. I mean, I guess you're kind of defending them here from this conspiracy, because they have enormously positive effects on this world. If there were no Maesters, how could they have the communication that can they have, like they have right now? How could they even? I bet like Dorne would not even be able to talk to the people in the North. Like, they prevent the fragmentation and certain culture, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Skills like read and write. I mean, they basically train most of the lordlings, and they transport history. They record it. Without them, there would be no knowledge at all, except what the singers sing. And hey, that has been a reliable source over the series.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that raises a good point. If there is a conspiracy between the Maesters, who communicate using ravens, Bloodraven and Bran would be pretty well positioned to uncover that conspiracy at this point, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I guess so. Especially since we heard the story that the ravens were first trained by the Children of the Forest.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist. I think that the Maesters will have heard at some point, or tried it, or took it over. I don't know. Perhaps it's only a children's story. It's hard to tell in that world.
True.
Yeah.
So, okay, I mean, shoot ahead with your questions.
Okay. Well, in your article, you describe all the betrothals and wardenships and that sort of thing, and the question came up then, do you think that Ned himself was maybe betrothed to someone? Like, maybe he didn't know about it, but he was not as free as we were led to believe?
That is entirely possible. I don't exactly know, because we have no information about it, but it is certainly possible. Like the betrothal talks that were between Tywin Lannister and Roster Tully about Jaime and Lysa. So too could there have been talks for Ned. I don't know who would have been an eligible candidate, but it is very much possible. But it wouldn't play that much of a role, because Ned simply had to take Brandon's spot. Perhaps they even accepted his love in Ashara Dane after his father heard about it. I don't know how many years are between the tourney and the outbreak of war. I don't know exactly. have to be 2 or 3 years, something like that.
Elio has talked about that, you know, Elio from Westeros.
Yeah.
From his research, it's a very gray area. It's not clear. It's about 1 year to 1.5, but it's not set, and Martin might in the end say that, you know, time is hard to measure.
yeah, he does that a lot.
So, yeah, that is the $64,000 question, exactly how long went by.
There's
a lot hinges on that.
It's definitely possible that Ned should be betrothed to someone, but if he was, nobody knew about it or cared.
I'm just saying in relation to Ashara, I mean, in one sense, yeah, the Danes are a powerful family, but in another sense, they're under the Dornish that you don't trust, and they're not a major house, so that might have been a step against Ned being able to, like, you might find out later, oh no, I'm not actually free to go with this woman.
Yeah, I simply wouldn't know whom he should have married, because there is no eligible candidate in the big family, if they wouldn't have tried to make up a gay marriage with Stannis or something like that. But I think we can rule that out.
Well, wasn't Cersei rejected as a match for Rhaegar?
Really, if that's a big revelation of the Winds of Winter, I'm going to throw the book into a corner.
No, I think Ned would have been a good husband for Cersei. I've actually talked about this before.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, he was weirdly even when he was saying, like, I'm about to do something that will completely destroy your life, so flee the country before your husband murders you and your children. He was all, like, stroking her face and being like, how long has he been hitting you for? I feel really bad for you. I'm sorry. So, yeah, he's a tender guy towards old Cersei, even though he then rejected her attempt to seduce him, which I'm disappointed they didn't put in the show. I think there was a lot of potential there, but oh well.
Yeah. I have to cut something.
Yep.
That's not usually the kind of thing that they cut. They usually
no.
Yeah, that's, but I think they had enough sex, and that was one of the most cheesiest sex sequences that would have been in the entire show, and it has to say something.
Some things come off a little harsher on screen than they do on paper. Like, I, for one, am glad they didn't have Theon kicking around the Night Watchman's head after it was cut off. I think that would have been a little, you know... Let's ease into things a little bit before we start playing football with the human head. And let's maybe pull back on the sex before you have Cersei propositioning Ned. You know, she's got a lot of brother and cousin fucking to do. Let's let her get that out of her system before we move on to Ed. Ned.
And again, one last kind of side question is how, you know, the Blackfish, do you think that, and his refusal to marriage, do you think that was maybe... maybe they had somebody lined up for him, and that's why Hoster Tully seemed to be so obsessed about it. Because, I mean, why is he so obsessed about his younger brother? I mean, younger brothers become maesters or go to the wall. Why is he so obsessed about him becoming married?
That could be just to offer an explanation besides the big conspiracy, because I always try to do that first. It could be because Hoster Tully had two girls first, and there was no heir in line. I mean, Edmure is a very young child. He's about, 10 years younger than Caitlin or something like that. And at the time that all these pacts were made, Edmure wasn't born. So with the Blackfish unmarried and war on the doorstep, one would have to assume that he would have liked to see another Tully heir in the line. I guess that's more of a reason, because it's the same thing as with Ned. There's not really a candidate that you would say presents itself as the next logical choice for the Blackfish.
Yeah, I always just assumed it was because, not always, like most things with these books, I don't know anything until I go online after I finish reading them and find out what I'm supposed to know. But I always assumed after reading that online that the reason Hoster was... disappointed that the Blackfish didn't marry was because he was having a hard time accepting that the Blackfish is gay. But that doesn't really answer the question of why the issue came up in the first place. You know, normally, as you say, they expect younger brothers to go do something other than necessarily, you know, marrying big and doing this and that. So it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense that the reason it became an issue was because marriage was somehow important. For some reason, you know, it wouldn't necessarily have become an issue, and the whole issue of the Blackfish maybe being gay and Hoster maybe having, you know, trouble accepting that wouldn't have even come up unless marriage was important to begin with, uniquely important for a younger brother in this case.
Well, I mean, the Wall and the Citadel and places like that seem to be places where somebody who was gay in this world could go to and take refuge, you know, to have an excuse not for getting married.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So they must have needed, they must have wanted him to do something.
Okay, that's all I have here.
All right, so I would suggest, or I would suggest on behalf of Stefan, who has already whispered in my ear, a little bird whispering in my ear.
But, I'm just a little girl, and I don't know much of these things.
But
you know, that we take a break here and resume with our discussion of the sample chapter for the Winds of Winter with the after the break or the next episode, as the case may be. So, signing off for now, I'm Sean Collins, and thank everybody for listening.
I'm Stefan Sasse, and I also thank you.
And I'm Amin, and thanks for listening.